so much time has gone by, but some things stuck out in my mind, especially on that mission. One thing is, and I remember, from what I've read about it so far, nobody has pointed out the fact that at our briefing that morning, they announced that they had captured Brussels, either the day before or 2 days before, shortly before. And they captured Brussels with the runways intact. So if anybody had mechanical problems or battle damage, instead of heading for Switzerland or Sweden, which was the practice up until then, we should try to make it to Brussels because the runways are intact and the American forces are in control. So it's never been brought out, but it's influential in the story of our crew because after all the battle damage, we were all set to bail out. I'll get into that. But we didn't think we could get back to England, so we headed for Brussels. Then that's where we were heading. I guess I should begin by my first indication of the battle. As a radio operator, I was not in the top turret at that time. At that time, over the target, and for a while afterwards, the engineer took over the top turret, and the radio operator operated bomb bay doors. They opened doors, dropped the bombs, made sure they were clear, and then after the all clear, we would close the bomb bay doors and come back and monitor the radio for any messages that might come in. And I had done all that after we dropped our bombs. And first indication that we were being hit by fighters was from the waist gunners on the intercom. And you could feel the bullets whizzing through the fuselage. And they both reported the Focke-Wulf 190s, as I recall, attacking. And our tail gunner was hit. Apparently, he was hit right from the very start and knocked out of his turret.
His name was?
Henry Puto. And he's only one of the two other members of our crew that's alive to my knowledge. He had wounds to his face and to his legs. We didn't know. We just knew he was wounded at that time. And we had lost one engine. And Krivik, the pilot, managed to get it feathered. But we had low oil pressure in another engine. I think it was the outboard engine on our right. Could have been the inboard, I forget which one on the right. And the other in the left hand side of the plane had low oil pressure and we couldn't get enough power. So he ordered me to go down and open the bomb bay doors. He didn't say we're going to bail out, but I knew that's the reason he wanted to open the bomb bay doors. So I went down and I was about halfway through opening the bomb bay doors when bullets started to whiz around the bomb bay. And that's the last I remembered. I don't know how long I was out. I got knocked out because I woke up by the up by the nose wheel, which is a lot further away from where I should, at least I was. And I woke up, I was off my oxygen tank. I had the portable oxygen tank with me. I was off that and I'd lost my helmet, and my head was buzzing, and I didn't know what was going on. I gathered my senses. The first thing I went for was the bottle of oxygen, and I got back on the oxygen, and then I started looking around for my helmet. I went to pick up my helmet, and it had been hit. It had hit right where it's a steel helmet with the hinges on either side for the ear flaps because of the earphones we wore, and it apparently hit just about where the hinge was and took the hinge off and let a big crease right through the helmet. And that explained why my head was buzzing. But I wasn't bleeding or anything. I felt it wasn't bleeding. So then I went back to the opening the bomb bay. They were half open at that point. So I went back to, and the firing had ended by that time. I went back to open them up again, and they're halfway open, but there was no power. We lost all our hydraulic fluid. So I cranked them open manually, which takes a little bit longer. When I got them open, I went back up to the pilot and told him I had bomb bay doors open. And he was in conference with the navigator at that time. His name was Dale. And they were deciding where to go and what to do. And they thought they couldn't maintain altitude, but at the rate we were losing altitude, we thought we could make Brussels. So he told me to go back down, close the bomb bay doors, they were going to head for Brussels, and get the wounded up on the flight deck where they'd be warm, because by that time, all three in the waist were wounded, the tail gunner and the two waist gunners were wounded. And I should mention to you, when I first came up on the flight deck to report the critic that I had the bomb bay doors open, he looked like he saw a ghost. His eyes went, what? His jaw dropped. And I don't remember much about the reaction from Dale. And about a week later in the hospital, Kurt came over to see me. He was in the same hospital. I said, you had the funniest look on your face. He said, you were covered with hydraulic fluid, and I thought it was blood. He said, I couldn't imagine somebody losing that much blood. So that's the humorous part. So I went back down and closed the bomb bay doors again. And we flew, I don't know, I'd say maybe we flew almost an hour, I guess. But gradually losing altitude, but we were still flying and heading towards Brussels. And when we thought we were close enough, we thought we'd drop down below the ceiling and get some, look and see on the ground, get some sight, you know, we could pick up rivers or something like that. And when we came through the overcast, nothing below us but water. We're about, I'd say 2,000 feet, no higher, and nothing below us but water. By then everybody was surprised at that point. In the meantime, while we were flying, as a radio operator, I was the medical fellow on board. I had the first aid kit, and I was supposed to administer whatever first aid I could. So I broke out the all the time we were flying towards Brussels. We had the wounded up on the flight deck, and I had broken out the first aid kit. And Paul, one waist gunner, wasn't wounded, but he was wounded, but he was able to treat himself. He helped himself to the sulfur drugs and bandaged himself up. And same thing with Bill Rand, the other waist gunner. He was able to take care of himself. Pluto was hit a little more seriously, a lot more pain, and I tended to his wounds as best I could. I gave him a shot of morphine. I remember giving him the shot because you couldn't pull his, those high altitudes, you couldn't pull his pants down and give it to him in the leg. I went right through his flying suit, right through his flying suit, heated suit and all, and gave him the shot of morphine, and it quieted him down. And then really I had nothing to do then until we discovered we were over the water. And of course Dale and Krivik, the pilot, had a hasty conference, and they assumed that we were over the North Sea, which was a correct assumption. So they just keep heading west and they'd hit England, which we did. But in the meantime, we stripped the plane. Anything that could be stripped out of the guns, ammo, anything we had was stripped and dumped in the ocean. And after about 25 minutes, what I did at that time, I was in constant touch with Air Sea Rescue. I'd give them an SOS and a signal, and they'd plot our course in case we did go down, they'd come out and get us. And I remember so clearly because while I was in touch with Air Sea Rescue, the rest of the crew was trying to throw the radio out, and I had to fight them off. I had to fight them off to, if you're going to get out in the water, I'd like to have somebody coming after me, so I thought it was important anyway. But when we got down, we were down around 1,200, 1,000 feet or so, not much higher, we came over England. And immediately, Kurt noted where we were. It wasn't far from where we would normally come in.
Now,
anyway.
Did you come over the White Cliffs of Dover? Or?
No. We came in closer to our north of there. We came in closer to our air base. He immediately knew where we were, and headed for the air base, and with his course set on the runway. Of course, at the sight of land, everybody cheered up. We were very happy then, and I guess Kripik thought he could get it down on the runway. We didn't have any hydraulic fluid or brakes or anything, so we'd probably run off the end of the runway, but that was better than bailing out, so we And we didn't have much altitude left. We knew 800,000 feet or so. So the big thing then was to get the wheels cranked down. And we had no problem with the main landing gear, you know, getting down, locked in place. But they couldn't get the nose wheel locked in place, I remember. And at that time, the rest, everybody that didn't belong on the flight deck went back to the waist to get ready for a crash landing, including the navigator and everybody else. The radio operator and engineer stayed up with the pilot and co-pilot. We all had positions we'd take to brace ourselves for the crash. Mine was behind the co-pilot. I'd say I don't think we were much more than 500 feet off the runway when Bugalecki finally got the nose wheel locked. And he came up, and I thought, you know, that we were going to come in on, and he was down there playing with it. I thought we'd allowed to be down there when we landed, and he'd get crushed then, but he...
And Bugalecki was the engineer?
He was the engineer. And I would say we didn't have much more than if we had 500 feet when he finally got up out of there and had him locked, you know, they let the pilot know they were locked in place. So we felt pretty good, braced for the crash. We knew it would crash, but, next, there's a little window by the radio set. When you're back behind the co-pilot, on your left-hand side in the fuselage is a window down by your knee, and I was looking at the whatever scenery you could see going by, and all I could see were trees, and I never noticed trees on our approaches before to the runway. But all I could see was trees, and the next thing I knew, Krivic was pulling me out of the wreckage. And that's about all there is to my tale at the castle, that you know.